Let's turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 10 as we want to read along with what we saw last week in 1 Kings. Trying to do it again. We're in 1 Kings 12 and 2 Chronicles 10, and they parallel each other very closely. So we were reading the first part of 1 Kings 12 last time, so let's start off this morning in 2 Chronicles 10 and read the first few verses here that will catch us up with where we are in 1 Kings. And let's read verses 1 through 5, and we'll ask Brother Aaron to read that. 2 Chronicles 10, 1 to 5. Brother Aaron. Okay, so this is what we were looking at in 1 Kings 12 last time, where the people came to Shechem, and we looked at some of the background there with some of the events that happened at Shechem in Bible history, just to get a little bit of a perspective on that, and at least a couple of very prominent or noteworthy events occurred there in history, going back to the book of Genesis. That's where Levi and Simeon destroyed the men of that place to avenge what happened to their sister Dinah. And so we saw that, and of course that had repercussions that lasted throughout the history of Israel, because one of the punishments, the curses that came upon them for their anger through their father, who was the prophet, Jacob, was that they would be scattered in Israel, and Simeon was within, they were given cities within the tribal territory of Judah. Levi ended up being scattered through Israel, but God turned that into a good thing as a reward for the faithfulness of the man Levi and his fear of the Lord, as he made a covenant with him for that his descendants would be the priests in Israel. So then they were given cities throughout the tribes of Israel that would give them the opportunity to fulfill their purpose to teach God's word to the people. I mean, how well or how effective is that going to be if they're all concentrated just in one area of the country? But when they were dispersed throughout the country, God had them in a position where they would be among all the people of Israel everywhere to do their job. Now, of course, what did we see happen so often? Unfortunately, that in many cases became a mechanism by which the unfaithful and wicked priests were able to take the people and lead them away from God. But that was contrary, obviously, opposite to what God had intended for their purpose. So, at any rate, what happened there with Simeon and Levi that had repercussions there through Israel's history as a result of the events there. And we also, as we considered that, and we see that Shechem is also the place in Judges chapter 9. They were the ones who backed Gideon's son, Abimelech, when he was deciding to make himself king. And so that was a rebellion against God and his way. That caused division in Israel. Ultimately, the men of Shechem and Abimelech were destroyed. So Shechem, here we're seeing it again. It was a place where rebellion took place in Judges, And there's going to be another form of rebellion taking place here in Shechem again. Now, the background of this, of course, is the fact that their king has just died, Solomon. And now it's time for them to anoint a new king. Having only had at this point now three kings, although with all three of them, Saul, David, and Solomon, all three of them, each of the three of them, reigned over Israel for 40 years. So the thing, the common elements to the first three kings, Saul, David, Solomon, were that they reigned over all the tribes of Israel. There was no division in the nation, in the kingdom. They reigned over the entire nation of Israel, and only those three did. And all three of those reigned for 40 years. So Israel's now had a king for 120 years, is what that amounts to. So they've had over a century to of this experience with having a king, whereas for the four centuries before that, for over 400 years prior to that, they'd had judges chosen by God, selected with each of the judges by God. Did not depend upon the family background or what tribe they were from. In fact, in so many of the cases, or a lot of the cases, we see the judges coming from, if you looked at their backgrounds, would anybody have tagged or predicted that person, somebody from that family would end up being the leader of Israel? So often it was very much contrary to what anyone would have expected. One that really stands out there, Jephthah. I mean, you look at his family background, he was rejected by the rest of his family because of an illegitimacy issue. Jephthah would have been probably the last person anybody would have expected, as he was dwelling apart from his family, but he loved God and served God, and so that was, he was the right one, and so God chose him. I mean, Gideon, he himself mentioned how his family was least in Israel, and then if you look at the religious background there, as his father was an idolater, so. Who would expect a righteous man to be the leader of Israel to come out of a family that was prominent in their idol worship? There are just a number of cases like that. But what it does show us and what it really illustrates is that God can see the hearts of all men, and he could choose the very best one that would lead Israel. That was the system of the judges, the system that God chose for his nation Israel. Well, they rebelled against that in 1 Samuel 8. They demanded to have a king like the rest of the nations. And in that very chapter when they did that, that's really going to be the focal point of our study in the next hour, Lord willing, when Israel did demand a king. They were rejecting God. And any time we're determined to go our own way, we're rejecting God, because God has a way, a right way for all of us to walk in and to live by. Our job is to find what that way is, to search his word, to seek him, so we'll know what is the right way to go. But when God tells us, here's what we should do, we need to find that and do that. But if we don't, if we're deciding to go some other way, well, but I want to do this. And that's what happens a lot of times, is we get our mind set on something different than what the Lord would have us to do. And we're trying to force things to somehow fit our ways into with God's, and that doesn't work out. That doesn't work out in a good way until we learn better. But that's why we have these lessons. So Israel ended up rejecting God because God is the one that chose judges for them. So when they said, well, we don't want to have judges anymore. Well, in 1 Samuel 8, Samuel took that pretty personally, didn't he? Because he was the judge. So when you're the judge and then all the people saying, we don't want to have judges anymore, we don't like that. Well, it would be kind of hard not to feel rejected Of course, they could see what Samuel's sons were like, but that was not the way that things worked with the judges. It was not like there was a... that's exactly what was going to happen and did happen with the kings, where you would have a successor that would be the sons of the judges. So when they saw the sons of... If you really looked at it in a logical way, when the people of Israel saw that Samuel's sons weren't following the Lord and they were taking bribes and things, shouldn't that have been something to say, well, we sure don't want to have a king because look at what could happen then, because one of them would end up being king next. Now, let's say if Samuel were a king, then one of those would be the next king. But when they're seeing what his children are doing, then they say, well, we don't want to have judges anymore. That doesn't make a lot of sense, except the fact that they were of the world, and they wanted to be like the world. And they said that we want to have a king like all the nations around us. So that's what they were determined to do. Now, did God anticipate, does God know the hearts of men such that he could foresee that's the direction that people would want to go in, and that they would ultimately do that? Of course, and all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 17, this was something that God had very specifically addressed in his law that he gave to Moses, as he gave commandments that would be in place at the time in which they would end up having a king. So God anticipated it to the point that he even gave commandments to cover that situation. But let's go back there to Deuteronomy 17 for a moment. And let's go ahead and read verses 14 through 20 just to see what God said centuries before. I mean, this is going to be 400 plus years before Saul ever became king of Israel. So this is how far ahead of it these words are with Samuel. Can you read Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20?
When thou art coming to the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the other nations about me. Thou shalt in any wise set a king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set a king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, nor to the end that he should multiply horses, for as much as the Lord has said unto you, he shall henceforth. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. It shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, and he shall write him a copy of this law in a book, out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and keep all the words of his law and his statutes to do them. That his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel.
All right, so was it a surprise to God, really, in that sense, then in 1 Samuel 8, when they said, we want to have a king like all the nations? No. And he had spoken about that. And in 1 Samuel 8, if we can go over there, well, just keep... What are some of the particular things that he was commanding that the king shouldn't do when they had them? Don't go where? Don't go to Egypt. And don't multiply what?
Horses.
Three things. Horses, wives, and silver and gold. All right, now, having just finished with Solomon, well, he didn't go to Egypt, but he married Pharaoh's daughter. Did he have a few horses? Did he have a few wives? Did he have some silver and gold? When God was telling them, okay, you're going to end up demanding a king, now wouldn't it make sense that the particular things God would command about kings would be the things that kings would be inclined to do? That would be contrary to, or would not be good for them or for the nation to have that kind of direction? Of course. And so God made that his part of his commandments. Because going in that direction was not going to be good for the people, which goes right along with what the Lord said to the people Israel in 1 Samuel 8, when they did demand a king, and God told Samuel, okay, give them what they desire. Let's turn over there now to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And this will be good preparation for next hour, like I mentioned, Lord willing. So we can come back to this then, so this should be fresh in everybody's minds. But let's read from 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. Brother Travis.
And it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel, and they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them.
All right, just from the argument they're using, does that really make a lot of sense to you? Samuel, you're getting old. Your sons aren't righteous. We don't want to have them to be over us. So what we really need is a king. I mean, that's foolish on multiple levels, as we can see there. But the fact that Samuel made his sons to be judges, did that mean that was who God was going to choose to be the leader for the nation? He wouldn't choose among Samuel's sons when they were like that. Well, Samuel still took that as that was a sting. He obviously hurt over that and felt rejection from the people over it. But what does he point out to Samuel? It's not Samuel they're rejecting. I mean, Samuel happened to be the judge there, but that whole system of having judges was what God had chosen and had served Israel well for all of those centuries. When they had a judge, the people followed the Lord because the judge was righteous. It was when the judge died and the next generation came along, that's when they would go away from the Lord again until he raised them up another judge, and then they would follow the Lord during that lifetime. But when God raised up a judge for the people, when did that ever go wrong for Israel? That never went wrong for Israel. The first judge, as he's called that in scriptures, Moses. Well, how did Israel do under Moses' leadership? How about Joshua? And then we can go from there. The ones that we know, Othniel, who was Caleb's nephew, was the next one, and Ehud, and then we had. Then you end up getting to Deborah, and you get to Gideon, and Jephthah, and Samson, Samuel. How many of those are called by name in Hebrews chapter 11 as part of the great cloud of witnesses that we're to look to as we look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, to run with patience the race that's set before us? I mean, they're there. They're called by name in that chapter. I mean, those judges are among the very best examples of having faith and serving God that we have in that we know of, and so to study them, to learn about them, and to use that as encouragement for us to follow the Lord, that's what they're there for. When was that ever a bad thing? That wasn't. So when the people said we don't want that system anymore, I mean this was going to be for their own harm spiritually. And God knew that, but they were rejecting God when they did that. But God said, go ahead and give them a king anyway. However, before they did that, he said, let them know what the king, having a king is going to be like. As we want to read a little bit further now in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verses 11 through 20, let's see, Brother Michael, can you read that, 11 through 20 here in 1 Samuel 8?
It said, this will be the name of the king that shall reign over him. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands, captains over fifties, and he will send them to ear his ground, to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed, and of your vineyards, and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which he shall have chosen you. The Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.
All right, so combine what he said in Deuteronomy 17 that we read with what he says here in 1 Samuel 8. So really with those, both of those places, before they ever had a king, God was letting them know exactly what it would be like to have a king. First, by the commandments that he gave for the kings that they would have, the things that they would do, which would be the things that kings would be very much inclined to do. And those things are covered right there in those words in 1 Samuel 8 when God said, this is what a king is like. This is what they do. All right, well, we see all that. Solomon was a righteous man. As we see that he had his... time there later in his life when his heart was turned away from the Lord, he did repent. But when we look at the life of Solomon as a whole, I mean, Solomon was a righteous man. However, he was king. as king, did he do things that kings do? And of course, part of that was so that God would have the example for us of someone who experienced all those things of the world. But that wouldn't have worked with one of the judges. I mean, God would not have done that, didn't do that with one of the judges, because that would go contrary to that system that God had for judges, for them to have multiplied, had that kind of wealth like Solomon had. That was something that would go along really only with a king. So God had his purposes with that. But the fact is, Solomon did those things. And the things that God told kings not to do in Deuteronomy 17, we see that Solomon did most of those things. And the things that he was describing in 1 Samuel 8, even though Solomon was righteous, he was still king, and as the monarch, did he wield that power that he had? He did. And so that's what sets the table for what's going on now here at the beginning of 1 Kings 12 and 2 Chronicles 10 that we're reading. Having now had a king for 120 years and having just been through Solomon's reign, who had more servants, more wealth, more servants than any ever before him, of course, or any that would be after him. How many of their sons and daughters would have been taken as servants? Now, as part of that, though, as we mentioned before, there was the negative side to having that. But under Solomon, the fact that he was righteous and God blessed them during his reign. Remember, silver and gold silver was counted as nothing during this time. So it's not like they didn't have any advantages as a nation under Solomon. They had 40 years where they had been at peace because of the conquering that David did, that God gave to Israel as blessing to David. Solomon reaped the benefits of that, as did all the nation. That's why they were sitting every man under his vine and fig tree, as the Lord put it. So they had 40 years where they were at peace. They had 40 years when they were prosperous beyond any scale that is normally seen. And so they have that on one side, but they still are under a king. And that king still is wielding his authority as king. And that's the part they're focused on right now. They're tired of that. Now, does anybody say, well, you tired of all, you tired of having so much silver that it's worthless? Are you tired of having peace where you're not having to fight anybody? But they were tired of having the king to be able to arbitrarily make decisions, as kings can do, with having all authority. And they can just say, okay, I'm going to take you and I'm going to do this with you. I'm going to do this with you. And whatever it is that is in his mind. And Solomon did that. Well, they're tired of that. So that's when they come together to Shechem. And when Solomon's son is now going to be made king of Israel, they have a demand. That if they're going to follow Rehoboam, Solomon's son's king, then their condition is that he lighten the load. That he does not rule in the same manner, that is, with the same force that Solomon did. Well, that's their demand. Now, there are a couple of ways that Rehoboam can go with that. He can acquiesce to the demand. He can hear the words and be agreeable to that. He could go the other way, and who are you to tell me what condition? I'm king, you don't get a condition. You submit, period. He can go that way and be very severe and harsh. And that's the issue, is which of the two ways is he going to go? And he's going to get contrary advice from his people. He's going to have a set of younger men that are his cohorts, and he's going to have some older men that served, had been experienced under Solomon's reign. And they're going to counsel him to listen to the people, to agree to lighten their burden. And then, as they said, they'll serve you forever. They're going to counsel that. The younger men are going to counsel, you go and tell them that it's going to even be harder on them now. And then the question is, who's he going to listen to? And we know what the outcome is going to be, because God's already foretold that there's going to be this division in the kingdom. So God's going to give favor to the words of the younger men to Rehoboam. Now, does that take a miracle to have some young, hot-headed advisors to say, you go tell them, give them what for? And then B, to have a young man who's now becoming king to be inclined to listen to that, as opposed to the ones that are saying, go softly. That's not a miracle. That's pretty natural. That's the way things tend to work. All right, well, there's a principle, in fact, that Solomon himself was well aware of, and we have as part of the words that God preserved for us through him in Proverbs. Proverbs 15 and verse 1. Proverbs 15 and verse 1. This is one that we should all know. We should all know these words by heart, even if we don't know the exact reference. And our children should know these words by heart, because how often does this come up? Just think of a given day in traffic. You can see what people do. When somebody cuts you off, there's a couple of ways you can deal with that. This can govern, because you don't often. Now, some people roll down the window and actually exchange words, not nice ones, but. A lot of times these principles can be carried forward. You don't even have to actually say something, but there's a principle of action, the way that we should treat people in situations when somebody's got their feelings up, when somebody's when they're angry and upset. We can go two ways, one of two ways with it. The one of the two ways that Rehoboam's got a choice in. So this particular proverb right here is very much involved in the situation that we're studying about right now. But let's go ahead and read that, Brother Jan.
A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger.
Now, and really, this is his choice of which kind of answer to give. He's either going to give a soft answer, or he's going to give grievous words. That's his option, isn't it? Now, if he listened to his own father, what would he do? Let alone the advisors, his father's advisors. Well, had these older men that had served under Solomon, had they heard such counsel? Had they seen such in practice? Yes. So they're actually counseling him to go that way of what Solomon taught and lived by, to give the soft answer and turn away their anger. That's what they're telling you. If you'll give this soft answer to them, it'll turn away their anger. They're going to calm down and they will be loyal to you. Now, the younger men are going to say, give them these grievous words. And then what's that going to do? And how often do you see with the kids, with their, and there are a few of you in here. I won't call any names. I'm not going to call any names, Trey. I know you've got some younger ones there. But, I mean, we've all been through it just about. But and some of you are still, you've got siblings in your house now. But even when you get older, I mean, you still get around, you're going to be around family. You're going to be around other people. You're going to be around people at work. I mean, it can happen, like I said, it can happen in traffic. It can happen in the grocery store. It can happen anywhere and everywhere. The devil's there. The devil's around. The devil's going to try to, he's going to try to get to us. So we're going to find ourselves in lots of situations where people are going to do things, and right then we're going to have a choice. I can respond, I can give a soft answer here, and I can turn away their anger, or I can give a grievous word here, and what's going to happen? So, it's true. I mean, the way people are going to respond. Now, there's some people that occasionally you're going to find somebody that's really so, it's like the Lord says. I mean, how many people don't love those who love them? The Lord tells us to love our enemies. If we only love those who love us, do not even the publicans so, he says. Most people in the world, just about everybody's going to love people who are good to them. By the same token, just about everybody, when somebody speaks softly to them, they're, whatever feelings they have, it's going to go down. Now, you're going to occasionally find somebody out there who's going to be such the exception that they're not even going to love people who love them. They're not even going to be nice to people who are nice to them. And that even when you give them a soft answer, they're still going to have something ugly to say. There's some that are that bad. But in any event, if we follow what the Lord teaches, by and large, when we give a soft answer, is that going to calm people down? Is that going to calm situations down? Yeah. Does it have to wait until people are grown up before that works? Or can that be tried at home? And it should be. Brother Tom?
No, I was just going to say, because either way, they decided to return with the grievous words, but we know what that's thrown on their head. Pulling poles right on their head.
They are.
This is
going to be gasoline on the fire in that sense. But why is this not a miracle for God to use this exact scenario to bring about what is his intended outcome, that he's going to divide the kingdom? I mean, this is working through very natural means here. And that is because we're looking at words here, i.e. the tongue, which comes from where? The mouth speaks from the abundance of what? So this is really, all of this is a function of the spiritual heart. Okay? The kind of words that are going to come out are going to be, they're going to come from the heart. So now we're looking at, in this sense, the age situation. How does that relate to the heart? Just because you're older, does that mean you're going to be more wise and that you're going to be... Some of the people you'll see acting the fool out there, I mean, they can be as gray-headed or more than I am. I mean, it's you see people, again, will sometimes do that. We can find plenty of examples of that However, especially when we're talking about if we're seeking God, does time make a difference? It does. Because what happens over time if we're seeking God?
We should get stronger and stronger in faith as the years progress.
That's right. We're going to grow. Our hearts will grow. And as our hearts grow, what's going to improve? The words that come out of our mouths. What is, according to James chapter 3, what is the most difficult task that we have spiritually speaking? If we don't already know this, let's just go over there to James chapter 3. Now he's going to set, he's going to mention what our ultimate goal is here in the beginning of this chapter. But let's read the first two verses, which we'll see what our overall goal is, and then we're going to see what is the most challenging part of that. James chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Trey, you got that?
My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive a greater commendation. Many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and also able to bind up the whole body.
All right, master, you're being a teacher. A teacher, by definition, this means you're going to speak more. Now, would the Lord desire that we all be teachers? Yeah, in 2 Timothy chapter 2, he tells us that in verse 24, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle to all men, apt to teach, patient, able to teach. His desire is for all of us to be able. However, until we grow and have that ability, we need to be very careful, because if we're in a position where we are teaching, we're going to be speaking more. And when we're speaking more, then we're going to have more to be on the hook for. We're going to have more, because we're going to give account, as Matthew 12 tells us, we're going to give account for every idle word that our mouths speak. So the more we're talking, the more we're going to have to answer for. So we need to be very careful about that and make sure we're not putting ourselves in a position when we're not ready where we're going to end up making our own judgment worse. So we have that caution, but then in verse 2, the reason is because in many things we offend all. We all offend. Now, we certainly live in a time where people are very quick to express about how their feelings are hurt and how they're offended by things that are that we might say or do. And it seems like, at least as far as what gets more attention, where people are demanding that other people's feelings be accommodated, is particularly by us. Brother Tom?
It's because Satan is the expert when he does.
That's right. And
if we try to push that onto others, they have no basis or even background foundation to even attempt to come back with a soft word.
Yeah, that's correct. But we live in an age where particularly if you say something against sin, if you call something a sin, and if you are standing against any kind of behavior to say, well, this kind of behavior is wrong, that's when people say, well, you've now offended me. You shouldn't shame me. You shouldn't judge me. You shouldn't. There are all those words out there. Well, people should feel ashamed when they're not doing right. We all should. Is shame and guilt bad? When you have something to be ashamed of and guilty of, no. So, but these are the kinds of words. No, you can't shame people for this or that. Well, we're not the ones that give shame. People should be ashamed themselves based on what they're doing and things they're saying. And what is our job? Our job is to speak the truth in love. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15 tells us to speak the truth in love. That is our job. We need to speak God's truth. But God's truth is going to, His word is going to, it's more powerful. Hebrews 4:12. It's It's more powerful, it's sharper, more powerful than any two-edged sword. It divides, it exposes the hearts of people. So when we say, here's what God says. Now we'll be accused of being hateful just to say, even in the most loving way, well, here's what our God says about this kind of thing. Well, then you're hating, you're shaming, you're judging, you're doing all these things, and you've offended me, my feelings are hurt, and you got to shut up. I mean, that's really what the bottom line is if you believe in God and you believe that anything is wrong, you've got to shut up. I mean, that's what Satan is, as Brother Tom is pointing out, Satan has deceived the world, so that's what the world is saying very loudly right now. Reason we're mentioning that is when he says that we offend all, he's not talking about, well, when we go out and speak God's truth in love, that we shouldn't do that because that's hurting everybody's feelings. He's not talking about hurt feelings right here. He's not talking about hurt feelings at all. That word offend means to ensnare. The root word is a trap stick, like where you make a snare to catch an animal, like when you're hunting. And so it's when you're ensnaring someone. Here it's talking about when you ensnare somebody in sin. That's what that word is used for in Scripture. Matthew 18, when he starts off in verse 1, take heed that you offend not one of these little ones. It's better if we had a millstone cast tied around our neck and we were cast in the depths of the sea than we should offend one of God's little ones. Offend, that is to lead one of God's children into sin. It's bad enough when we go into sin ourselves, but when by our actions or our words we cause somebody else who's following the Lord to turn away from the Lord to go into sin. What's worse than that, when we're not only sinning ourselves, but we're causing somebody else to? I mean, that's really as bad as it gets. So that's what he's talking about there. Do our words have the potential, if we're not speaking good words and right words in the right way, are we capable of causing other people to sin with things we say? Can we be a stumbling block to others by the things that we say? Well, just looking at that Proverbs 15:1, we go on there with grievous words and we're stirring up anger. We can provoke people to anger and to do things. And so, again, that's different than, I mean, as Jesus pointed out in John 7 and verse 7, he says the world cannot hate you, but me it hates. Because I testify of it that their deeds are evil. If we're of the world's going to love us. But as soon as we testify that the actions that are going on in the world are evil by God's standard, then that's going to bring where the hate is going to be turned against those who are doing that. And that's what happened with Christ. We have to do it in the right way. Again, that's not what he's talking about there. Speaking God's truth in love. That's our job. And if somebody's hates us for that, that's on them, that's not on us. But if we aren't speaking right words in the right way, if we're using grievous words or we're stirring up anger, we're provoking people to do things because of the way that we speak, then we can cause others to become ensnared in sin. And so if we do not offend in word, and what he's gonna, the way he's gonna describe that as he goes forward here in James 3, bridling our tongue. In fact, in chapter 1 is where he first brings that up. If we don't bridle our tongues, in James 1 and verse 26, if any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. How serious is this? You seem to be religious. We're here all the time. Every time the doors are open, here we are. We're doing all these things that we're supposed to do as being Christians, as being religious. But if we're not bridling our tongues, then what is all of that? If we don't bridle our tongues, it's all going to be in vain. We don't want that to happen. We don't want our seeking, wanting to be fulfilling our role in the body of Christ, being here whenever we assemble, being involved in all the works that we need to be involved in of the church, and encouraging one another and being there for each other on a daily basis, all those things. We don't want to do all of that and then it be in vain because we have not bridled our tongues. That is our hardest job, because when we're able to bridle our tongues such that we do not offend, we do not cause anyone to sin by the words that we speak, at that point, what are we in verse 2 of James 3? The same is a perfect, that's the complete man, and able also to bridle the whole body. If you can bridle your tongue, what can you also? What are you going to also be able to bridle at that point? Everything else, which says, what's the hardest job? I know what my hardest job is. I make no bones about that. I know what my biggest struggle is, and I've got to work on my tongue. And being able to say the right thing in the right way in every situation, that's hard. When we grow to the point, when our heart grows and grows and grows, we should be getting better and better. We should be bridling it better and better and better. But we need to grow to that point where we're spiritually complete and able to actually bridle our tongue, not cause any offense with our tongues, and then we'll be able to bridle the whole body. And how much are we going to be sinning then? When we stop committing sin with our mouths, we're really not going to be sinning with anything else. And that's the point that he's making there. And that's our goal. Our goal is to grow in heart to the point where we're complete. And when we are complete, well, what's going to be in the heart that's evil that will be the source of evil words and deeds then? See, there's our spiritual goal. But he shows us the words, the tongue, that's the hardest part. So then what would we expect in youth? Very easy, very quick to not having grown enough in the wisdom and in the practice of bridling the tongue to do those things. So who would we be expecting to counsel Rehoboam, you go give him these grievous words? It's really not a surprise, is it? And it shouldn't be a surprise that older, especially older men that have served under Solomon, where he had all of that wisdom, like we're seeing with the Proverbs and everything about the tongue there. And by the way, there's a lot more about the tongue in Proverbs 15. And verse 1 is one of the greatest. But then there's several more right after that. It's worthy of looking at. But these older men have been around to hear that wisdom and to see it in practice for all those years. I mean, so not only older men in general, but older men that served Solomon. I mean, if you were going to have some good advisors, how could you do better? We would expect the counsel from those older men to be better than even your average wise older men. And they give him good counsel. He's not going to listen to it. He's young. He's going to like the sound of the advice of the younger ones telling him to go give those grievous words, and it's going to stir up anger and it's going to split the kingdom. That's what's going to happen. But we know that it's of God, but this is the mechanism how it's going to happen, using the foolishness of the tongue in the hearts of some young men. It's not the only time that this kind of thing happens in Scripture. It's not the only time we see things like this. It's good to learn this. There's a reason we're spending the time on it. Young and however old we are, we've got a good age range in here. I'd say our total, well, of course, if we include over there, we got over 80 years of gap in ages in here. So we've got a long spread here for as far as experience is concerned. This is for all of us, though, as we need to think about in principle and then put in application so that we do better. So we can see this. Here's an object lesson of what happens when our tongues aren't bridled and we haven't grown in heart and we don't have enough wisdom and the kinds of things that words can do. I don't know, you remember that old saying when we all learned as kids, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That isn't true. Words can hurt a lot and can cause a lot of problems, as we just saw in James 3. And this, what's going to end up causing this issue that splits the kingdom, it's going to be words. So we'll see the power of that. There's life and death is in the power of the tongue. God says that there's great power in the tongue. We'll see that on display here, but we can learn from that what not to do. All right, well, we're out of time this morning, so we'll stop here.